Israel Update with Gadi Taub and Mike Duran.
Hello and welcome to Tablet's Israel Update. It's been 185 days to this war. It's 9th of April 2024. I'm Gadi Taub, not in Tel Aviv and not at the Hudson Institute in Washington, but on vacation in Medellin, Colombia, which doesn't stop me or us from continuing to cover the war for you. Mike, however, is ensconced as usual in the safety of the headquarters of the Hudson Institute. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You know, I've seen too many movies and where Colombia adventure movies where your Medellin is the center of the cartel. And when I see a guy in Medellin with a refrigerator behind him, I wonder
what's in it?
Whose head do you have in that refrigerator? Or how many stacks of cash do you have in there?
That's information I can't disclose. I'm here on a special mission to acquire arms since your government is not supplying enough of them. But other than that, I'm vacationing. So why don't we start with the headlines, because it's been a baffling week.
Right. No, a lot has happened. And instead of reading the headlines as usual, I'm going to run through the major events and then tell you what I think is going on, if you don't mind. I'll tell you a story. The last week, of course, last Monday, we had two major events. That's the Israeli strike in Damascus, and we had the Israeli strike in Gaza that killed the World Central Kitchen workers. I think that set the ball rolling. And then we had a conversation between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu on Thursday. And I want to read you the American readout of that conversation, because I think it's very revealing. I used to write these when I was in the White House. They never tell you the whole story and sometimes even the main point, but they never lie, I don't think. And this one I think is very revealing. President Biden spoke by telephone with Prime Minister Netanyahu. The two leaders discussed the situation in Gaza. President Biden emphasized that the strikes on humanitarian workers and the overall humanitarian situation are unacceptable. He made clear the need for Israel to announce and implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. He made clear that the U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment, that's the American assessment, of Israel's immediate action on these steps. He underscored that, this is a really important point here, he underscored that an immediate ceasefire is essential to stabilize and improve the humanitarian situation and protect innocent civilians, and he urged the Prime Minister to empower his negotiators to conclude a deal without delay to bring the hostages home. The two leaders also discussed public Iranian threats against Israel and the Israeli people. President Biden made clear that the United States strongly supports Israel in the face of those Iranian threats. So then, following that call, a number of dramatic things happened. The Israelis announced a pullout of their maneuver forces from the Gaza Strip. Prime Minister Netanyahu authorized his team, that's the led by the director of the Mossad, to go to Cairo to meet with the CIA director, Bill Burns, the Qatari prime minister, the Egyptian chief of intelligence, as well as those people representing Hamas, to negotiate hostages for prisoners deal. We have now the latest information coming out of Gaza on that, or coming out of Cairo on that deal. It's one line of reporting coming out of the Israelis is that the Israelis are optimistic that there might possibly be a deal. Another line of reporting is saying no, the Hamas is sticking to its traditional demands, which are unacceptable. The nub of the disagreement between the Americans who tabled the proposal there in Cairo and Hamas is that the American proposal focuses on the ceasefire and the hostages for prisoners' release. It calls for a limited number of Gazans to go back to the northern Gaza Strip, but it leaves everything else about the extension of the ceasefire, the return of people to the north in larger numbers, and the end of the war to further the negotiations. Hamas is demanding all these things up front, an end to the war. What Hamas is saying is, if we release all the hostages, then Israel will just go in and destroy us. We have to have a guarantee of an end to the war. So the distance really seems to be quite far. The question here, Gadi, is what is this? What's the meaning? The overall meaning of the withdrawal of the maneuver forces of the Israelis from Khan Yunis and from the Gaza Strip? Are the Israelis buckling to American pressure? Effectively being blocked from going into Rafah, or is this just a temporary pause, operational pause, which will be followed by an operation into Rafah? There was an exchange in the Israeli government that it also is very revealing. Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, the two right-wing members of Netanyahu's coalition, the most right-wing, reacted to the reports about progress in talks toward a hostage deal, and to the IDF troop withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. Smotrich sent a letter to Netanyahu, which was made available to the press, in which he complained that he and other security cabinet ministers were being sidelined, and they called a meeting with Netanyahu. Netanyahu responded with a public statement, which is very interesting. He said, quote, "We are constantly acting to achieve our objectives, first among them the release of all our hostages and the attainment of total victory over Hamas. That victory mandates an entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. That is going to happen. There is a date." So Netanyahu is trying to allay fears that the Americans have successfully blocked him from going into Rafah, but it's also clear that the Israelis have buckled to American pressure to a certain extent. They're trying to put a good face on it. This is my analysis. They're trying to go to put a good face on it. They're trying to say, we are, look, anyway, the troops need a rest. Anyway, we need to prepare to go into Rafah. So we'll go with the Americans as far as we can, see if we can cut a deal in Cairo. If not, then we're going into Rafah. So the question is, what's actually going to happen here? Clearly, the Americans thought they could get a deal. They put enormous pressure on the Israelis. They put enormous pressure on the Qataris and the Egyptians to pressure Hamas. But they have not gotten from Hamas what they want, which is a deal. And the Americans are caught here in this dilemma that the more pressure they put on the Israelis, the more they incentivize the Hamas to hold out. So in order to get Hamas to cut the deal that the Americans want, the Americans actually have to have pressure from the Israelis to go into Rafah. So how this is going to resolve itself is really unclear. One last point, it was only mentioned slightly in that readout from Biden on Friday, but I think hanging over all of this is the fear in Washington of an escalation between Israel and Iran. And the American answer to the possibility of an Iranian response to Israel that will engender another attack by Israel against Iran is to just shut down the Gaza war. And that's, we could see the diplomatic messaging between the Americans and the Iranians, we'd see the administration saying to the Iranians, hold it, don't do anything. We're gonna shut down the war in Gaza. Give us a chance. That's what I think is going on right now.
Yeah, so this is very interesting, and I'll add a couple of comments on this very convincing analysis, Mike. One is to emphasize something that you've been saying all along, and you said now in another way, is that the bind for the American administration is the more pressure they apply on Israel, the more Hamas hardens its positions, and so they are caught in a quagmire. So the fact that Netanyahu is, or the Israelis are saying that a deal is closed, maybe setting the scene for saying, look, we tried, Hamas is not letting us do the deal. We are ready for the deal. By the way, the deal will be very unpopular in Israel. This, we get a wrong impression because of the noisy demonstrations. Most Israelis understand that finishing this war only with returning our hostages would probably mean that there would be many more future hostages, and that we, and they know that we can't afford to lose to the weakest of our enemies and leave our blood in the water in this dangerous region. Secondly, we will see what how the pullout affects the north of the Gaza Strip, because if the pullout is just from the maneuvering forces, it's one thing. But if forces are reduced in the north of the Gaza Strip and allowing Gaza residents to return there, then Israelis will know that a lot of the war gains are just being lost, and this will cause a great uproar here. Secondly, there is thirdly, there is a limit to how much Netanyahu can, even if he wants to, go towards shutting down the war, because there are about 150,000 still evacuees from the north and from the Negev, and these people will vote with their legs, and no government will be able to stand
Vote with their feet. I'm sorry.
With their feet. We say let's be about alive, not by kapot.
Yeah, Hebrew doesn't have a distinction between leg and foot. That's
yes, we do. We kapot or glide, but nobody says.
Oh, kapot or glide. Yeah, yeah.
You think nobody says you vote with kapot or glide. So with their feet, by not returning home, and this is a pressure the government, no government will be able to stand in the long run. So although we have a very, very noisy leftist, maybe 10,000 people who are demonstrating in Tel Aviv or around the Knesset, we have 150 internal refugees who will eventually form a greater pressure. That's not to mention all the reservists and all the rest. There will be a great difficulty for any government to explain that we have sacrificed so many servicemen for nothing. And lastly, the question of Iran. Last week, we discussed at length the hit on Iranians, on senior officers in the Revolutionary Iranian Guards. And if this game is being played in a sophisticated way, then Israel may be sending two signals together. I'm not privy to any such discussions in the government, so I'll allow myself to guess. But what if now Israel wages an attack on the Houthis on its own? There are various other arenas and theaters in the region with which we can play a sophisticated game. However, to that we must add the fact that the government is regrettably, or so it seems, not in complete control of the military. This has been going on since the reform, and increasingly we get signals that whenever the government wants to act boldly, the military is creating obstacles. And so we have reached the strange situation in which the government needs the approval of the army command in order to implement some of its policies. And regrettably, a lot of the army command is very close to the American military, and the American military is more loyal to its democratic government currently. I'm not sure how it would be if the army has gone so woke as the news say, what would happen in the Trump administration. But for now, they are in line with the American policy, and it's not clear that our military is not. So I'll end by quoting my friend Shimon Riklin, who is an anchor for Channel 14. He has Riklin and Company. He has his own show. And he said, look, in the Army, in the IDF, there are two kinds of officers. There are American officers who compose most of the Israeli brass. And then there are actual Israeli officers who are willing to go in there and fight. And the American officers, which comprise most of the command, are not so intent on winning wars. They are more concerned with being the most moral army in the world. And their strategic conception is that our dependence on the U.S. is not just a material thing. It is also an emotional, even a spiritual thing, because they trust the shikul dat,
the considerations,
the responsible consideration of our rational elder brother, who is the responsible adult in the room, in their opinion. And as we know, they don't even imagine that the responsible adult is responsible towards Iran more than it's responsible towards us.
Shikul dat would be judgment.
Sobriety of judgment.
Sober judgment. Okay. Well, very interesting. I, of course, have no opinion about that question of the IDF, the composition of the IDF. As someone who's looking from the distance, I think I told you I once had a conversation with Gabi Ashkenazi, former IDF chief of staff, over the disagreement that he had. It was very well reported between, on the one hand, it was at the time Ehud Barak and Netanyahu versus the head of the Mossad, Meir
Ben Shabbat.
Head of the Mossad, Meir Dagan.
Yeah.
Meir Dagan and Gabi Ashkenazi over whether to attack Iran. This is back in 2012.
And Meir Dagan at least said that he went to the Americans and reported the plans and had them stopped.
He had conversations with the Americans. I don't think he said he went and reported them. They knew anyway, in his view. Anyway, it doesn't matter, that part. The thing is that they had this disagreement, and I asked Gabi Ashkenazi about it, and he told me, look, I was against. He said, I'm a Ben-Gurionist, and I believe that you don't go to war without great power support. It's a serious argument. It's a very serious argument. I don't think we should belittle it at all. Israel, for all its capabilities, for all its talents, remains a very small, vulnerable country.
That is true, but a Ben-Gurion would have thrown Gabi Ashkenazi right home for defying the civil authorities. Ben-Gurion thought, unlike today's establishment, that the Minister of Defense, we call it the Minister of Security. I don't know why, whenever we translate it, even in the press, we call it the Minister of Defense. But the Minister of Security, Sar HaBitachon, should be a civilian, not a general, because now we have someone like Gallant who is representing the army in the cabinet instead of imposing the cabinet's authority on the army. So he belongs to the same social clique and even to the same labor union, although that's not a formal thing. It's his training, his thought, his loyalties, and his commitments are to the people he's supposed to supervise. So, well, let me run another thought by you, Mike, which I know I'm not the first to run by you. What if the plan is, and we're both in the dark, we have to say, we've been talking about this on the phone ever since the pullout, trying to tap all our sources. It's not clear to any of us what the plan is, but one option that both of us heard about and considered was, instead of going into Rafah, just aiming for the Philadelphia border with Egypt, because one of Israel's major concerns and the reason we cannot win the war where the IDF is now, let alone where it will be after redeployment, is that we don't control the border with Egypt, which is the main route for smuggling arms. There seem to be a net of underground highways in this part of Gaza, and we can't stop. We don't know if the hostages have not been smuggled through it outside of Gaza and maybe to Iran and maybe to another hostile country in the area. And the Hamas leadership itself can escape and start regrouping if we don't block that road. Do you think it's a viable possibility for the IDF to blaze a trail along that border and occupy it?
So your idea here is just to make sure we're on the same page, your idea here is that in negotiating with the Americans, The Israelis say, okay, we won't go into Rafah proper, but we'll take the Philadelphia corridor, and that would be the first stage of a Rafah of a Rafah operation, and they would hold the corridor. There's two parts to this question. One is it operationally feasible? I wouldn't, and that's a technical military question that I don't know. I don't see why it wouldn't be. There is going to be this question of all the displaced people. Very large percent, some significant percentage of all the displaced people from the north are there along the corridor. So that'll be part of the negotiation with the Americans. I don't know what the Israelis gain if they're going to go for that. Why not go for the whole enchilada? But if they can only take half a loaf, then that would be better. Of course, it would be better because they would then control the passages.
The advantage, Mike, would be that the American hypocritical concerns about humanitarian considerations. I'm saying hypocritical because, you know, it's a Muslim for me, but not for thee. So as Eugene Kantorovich, Professor Eugene Kantorovich quipped, when America attacks someone who kills their citizens, they're much less scrupulous.
Mosul and Raqqa, I mean, we laid waste to both of those cities. No, what I mean is, look.
But what I wanted to say is that the advantage is you can do this, the problem is the mass of population. And if you can concentrate the mass of population inside Rafah, north of the Philadelphia corridor, then you can do this while abiding by the American imposed limitations.
Well, the question is, and you, which you raised with your adjective hypocritical, to what extent are the American concerns about humanitarianism their real concerns? And It's my view that the humanitarian concerns is the tool that they are using to slow down, shut down the Israeli operation.
Of course,
the Americans want the war to stop, and that's pretty clear from the readout of Biden's conversation on Thursday, because he said we need an immediate ceasefire. That's right. What they want to do, I think, pretty obviously. Obviously, they're not saying this. They want a hostages for prisoners agreement that'll last for a month and a half, and then during that month and a half, they want to negotiate a longer ceasefire. And the closer we get to November, the November presidential election, the more the American pressure on the Israelis to stop the war is going to increase. So my point is that if the Israelis can get this from the Americans, we'll take the corridor, but we'll put the larger Rafah operation into a bay, into the future at some later time. Go ahead, take it and go for it. But I think they're gonna find the American opposition to the Philadelphia corridor to be exactly as intense as the opposition to Rafah itself.
But maybe easier to negotiate. I'll say that I'm not always as cynical about America's concern for human rights. I studied in America for my PhD in American history. And as I told you privately, but I'm not sure I informed our listeners, there were only two people in my class. This is the end of the 90s. It's not yet total woke. There were only two people in my class of PhD students were willing to say anything good about America, whatever. And these were myself and a Japanese student who did diplomatic history. All the rest just badmouthed America for 3 years. It was unbearable to hear. So America is not always cynical. It's a great force of good in the world. But this administration is very cynical in its use, in its selective use of human rights. Like, beginning to be like the UN. And may I remind you of something that I know you don't forget because you dwell on it 24 hours a day, is that the minute this administration came into power, it took the Houthis out of the list of of a terror organization, and what was the excuse? Humanitarian. That the
exactly.
Saudis
exactly.
were violating human rights. And then, of course, Iran doesn't violate human rights, but Khashoggi, that's a violation of human rights that we can't forget.
Look, there's a reason why you have to have analysis. You have to have it. I worked in the White House. I worked on the Middle East. I would sometimes, I loved it when you'd go into the Oval Office and the president would have to have calls. You know, the presidents, they do their calls to foreign leaders in the morning, and they'll schedule them back to back. So there'll be the call with Angela Merkel, and then the call with Putin, and then the call with the King of Jordan, and then the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And when you go in and you brief them, they don't like people coming, at least in our administration, they don't like people coming in and out of the Oval Office. So you stay for all the calls. So I love those because I loved hearing the calls with Putin, the calls with Angela Merkel, the calls with Xi Jinping, whoever it happened to be that morning, because when you're a staffer, the phrase they always use is you see the world through a soda straw. You just see your issues all the time, and you lose sight of the larger global picture. And so I'd sit there and I'd listen to Merkel talking to Bush or Putin talking to Bush, whoever it is, and I start to see so that's how my issues are intersecting with everything else he's got to deal with. And sometimes, you know, I was in charge of the whole Middle East except Iraq, so I also didn't have the Iraq war. So I also liked those opportunities when I would get to see how the Iraq war was impinging on other things. And sometimes the president would make decisions that would surprise me, and I would not, on my issues, and I wouldn't understand, and I had to wait and listen to a phone call or ask somebody, why did he do this, why did he not do that? So what I'm trying to say is, there were very few people in the United States when I was in the White House who had more information about what was going on in the White House about the Middle East, and I was still sometimes surprised. So yeah, you can't, even when you're that close and you have nearly perfect information on the decision making, you still have to analyze and say what's the priority. So we don't have to be cynical about it. I do think it's cynical. I think it's very cynical, but. We don't have to go to cynicism to explain what's going on. The Biden administration has a number of considerations simultaneously. It is concerned. It says it itself all the time. It's concerned about escalation with Iran. Doesn't want escalation with Iran. It's concerned about the election. It tells us all the time. It's concerned about the election.
It's concerned about Taiwan and Ukraine.
Concerned about Taiwan and Ukraine. So all of this means that yes, there are a large number of people in the White House and in the State Department at any given moment who the number one thing for them is climate change or humanitarianism or whatever. So that's always floating around in the atmosphere. But the guys at the top have to, even if they don't know they're doing it, even if they're total idiots, they still have to prioritize one thing over another. They have to have some picture in their mind about how these different things intersect. So they may believe, when they say we're very concerned about humanitarianism, they probably think they are concerned about humanitarianism. But I, as an analyst of them, I notice that they never care about humanitarianism in Syria. They never care about humanitarianism in Iran. Right? What are we doing? What are we doing for all of those women who were being oppressed in Iran? Nothing. We're not doing anything. But we care very much about restricting our ally Saudi Arabia over humanitarianism. We care much about restricting our ally Israel over humanitarianism. It's just that we never care about restricting our enemies over humanitarianism. So I conclude that there are other factors at work here.
And let me offer a rule of the thumb of how they do it. When they are putting pressure that would be unpopular with their voters, some of whom like Israel, they need moral grounding for it. And so while they can explain hostile measures towards enemies when they are serving enemies at the expense of allies, they need to coat this with fake moral considerations. And
I'm only interrupting you to say yes, exclamation point, yes. Okay, go on.
I'm sorry that I disturbed you when you were about to say something so important. but I wanted to add this piece of information is that according to estimates, by the way, American and Israelis, the ratio of non-combatant casualties to combat casualties are among the lowest in the world. Some are saying that this is a record in urban warfare. Some are estimating that the ratio is 1.7 civilians for every combatant, while according to the UN, the average in such conflict is 1 to 7. So despite the extreme density of the population in Gaza, in spite of all the high-flying moral rhetoric, Israel is actually extremely careful and has killed little civilian. And instead, the president is taking at face values the Hamas numbers of casualties, which, according to our experience, are highly, highly reliable. As we all know, Hamas, let me do the Unger thing. Our Hamas would never lie about such a thing.
No, it's terrible. It pains me greatly when the president of the United States repeats from the podium of the president propaganda of our enemies. And he did that in the State of the Union when he said 30,000 civilian deaths. Those are the number. 30,000 killed was the number coming out of the Gaza Ministry of Health, which is a Hamas organ, and which doesn't count combatants. There are no, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health, there's never been a Hamas fighter killed. Everyone's a civilian. So already it's bullshit. Total bullshit. The president should never, ever, ever say such a number from the podium. Then there are all the other factors as well about all the lying. But you see what you did. This is why I had to contradict you. People sometimes in the or interrupt you. People sometimes in the comments to our podcast complain that I interrupt you, Gadi. They complain, and I just want to say, this is because I knew you were going to move to a separate issue. I would still want to underscore what you said. It is politically illegitimate for the president of the United States to say he is restricting Israel in order to cut a deal with Iran. He cannot say that. So what does he say? I'm restricting Israel because I'm concerned about humanitarianism. Humanitarianism, humanitarianism. Exactly right. 100% correct. And it can't be said enough. It is amazing how many people take that at face value, too. The whole analysis these days and the conventional wisdom as to why Israeli-U.S. relations have fallen out just repeats the talking points of the White House as if there's nothing else going on.
And we are here to emphasize that they are doing it because they want to appease Iran. And it has been my opinion from at least the middle of this war that Prime Minister Netanyahu should start saying it too. Prime Minister Netanyahu should start hinting that he will expose the appeasement policy towards Iran. You don't have to do it all out right up front, but I belong to the Ben-Gurionist school, if you allow me to turn your Gabi Ashkenazi argument on its head, which said that there is actually room of maneuver even if you are in a confrontation with a superpower. I just want to mention as a footnote that the quote from Batya Unger is she made fun of those people. It's not that her position, that Hamas would have never done that, and that you could listen to her whole brilliant talk if you go to our Rumble channel. And a few episodes back, we put on a whole webinar about Telos, about sexual crimes and the feminist reactions in the West on October 7. And that is a good opportunity to mention, Mike, that our Rumble channel has now more than 20,000 followers. Did you know that? We celebrated 10, we didn't celebrate 20.
Oh, I did not know that. I did.
And now we also have a YouTube channel where we have, I think, 200 followers, but it's a nice beginning.
Only 200. We had people send me emails all the time. How come you're not on YouTube? How come you're not on YouTube? We're on YouTube now. So,
yeah,
come on.
Yes, we are. But mostly we are now on audio at tablet. And though we don't have a counter there, my guess is that as podcasts go, audio reaches far wider audiences. So you can now assume that anything you say here will be known far and wide and will probably be taken into consideration in the inner halls of the administration, including the Oval Office, where I'm sure they're listening to us.
Yeah, I think you think President Biden is listening to podcasts?
Yeah, while he's taking calls with world leaders. It's funny you're there. He's known for his ability to
multitask. I lost my train of thought. I had a thought that was, I had up there a bullet ready to fire, and then it got to my moment. I don't have it anymore. I lost it.
And so because our time is almost up, why don't we go straight to the dumbest stake? And
I hope you have a good one, because I don't have one this week. I apologize.
I have one from Tamir Pardo, which being so positive will make you laugh that I'm willing to put money on it. And here is what former head of the Mossad, Tamir Pardo, said 4 days ago. If Sinwar would know how to read Excel sheets, he would have known he was defeated.
Oh, my Lord.
You didn't laugh. You didn't laugh.
Because it pains me. I'm sorry. It is ridiculous. It is ridiculous.
It's beyond ridiculous. It's beyond ridiculous, and it just shows.
I didn't laugh because I'm crying. I'm crying.
It just shows you. It just shows you how the Concepcija had us totally blinded. They have their set of rational considerations. And you know what it reminds me of? The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It is said in the book about the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that in every instance where reality does not fit its description in the guide, it means that reality is inaccurate. these are the brass that led us into this terrible mistake. And I have to say, Yahya Sinwar understands what victory and defeat mean in the Middle East far better than the heads of our Mossad. And here's the rub. This is why we are now not understanding what Israel must do in order to prevent the downgrading of our strategic situation in the Middle East. Any final thoughts, Mike?
Nope, that was a good one. We just have to introduce to American thinking and to Israeli thinking decisive victory. It is actually possible to win wars, but you have to define it clearly, and you have to develop a strategy for achieving it.
And I can add a quote from Bismarck, who said, "Woe to the statesman who can't explain the goals at the end of the war, which were clear to him in its beginning." This is also why you need to be careful but this time I think we had it right. I think the war aims were defined well. Since I'm traveling, Mike,
the Bismarck quote reminded me of a very embarrassing moment for me. When I was a graduate student and I was first starting to write my thesis, I was invited by a professor to have dinner with another very, very distinguished professor. I was very excited to have dinner and to see the great man. He asked me what my thesis was about. And I started talking and I rambled on for, 35 minutes. I don't know how long. I was excited, exuberant to talk about the thesis and all that it meant. And he responded to me by saying, in my experience, if you can't say what your thesis is about in two or three sentences, then you don't know yourself.
They say the same things to screenwriters, but I suspect that in your case, he was wrong.
I'll tell you this: it's a conversation I will never forget. and I ask myself now when I go to write an article, if I have to summarize it in one sentence, what is it? Because it's an important thing to learn to do. In war as in writing.
In screenwriting, it's well known that if you don't have a good one-liner, you probably don't know what the center of your drama is. But I can finish with a counter argument, because I know you're writing and I know you write long things and they are very detailed and you're very scrupulous about the details. So this is an argument a former friend of mine, he no longer speaks to me on political grounds, had with a famous pundit in Haaretz, and he sent Haaretz a very long essay, and the editor in Haaretz said, it's my experience, and this was an old time editor, it's my experience that anything that you can say in 6,000 words you can also say in 300, to which he responded, yes, anything you say in 6,000 words can be said in 300. And on that happy note, I wanted to tell you that since I'm traveling, I'm not sure we'll be able.
Sorry. I know we're going to close this podcast, but that reminds me. Do you remember there was an old joke?
We are impossible, Mike.
There was an old Woody Allen joke where there used to be these Evelyn Wood speed reading courses, and when I was growing up, everyone knew what Evelyn Wood was. And he said, Woody Allen said, I just took an Evelyn Wood speed reading course. I read War and Peace in an hour. It's about Russia.
So my surprise to you is that if we are unable to record because I'm traveling, we have what we call an in-depth special with Professor Kobi Michael. And it is about the Hamas-Iran long-term plan of how to annihilate Zionism, and it's a plan we are not discussing enough in the Israeli press or elsewhere. And Professor Kobi Michael is a very interesting guy, not just because he's a researcher, by the way, at INSS and also at Misgav, but because he was on the ground in charge for the army on coordinating the joint security forces in the beginning of the Oslo days. And ever since, he's been involved in every negotiation with the Palestinians and several government capacities, then in several academic capacities. He knows the names, the places, the people. When he says, when I try to get into Sinwar's head, your ears prick. Because you know, he knows more than others. And I've recorded a 45-minute conversation with him about this, and it's going to be highly interesting. So I recommend to you, Mike, to tune in, as I recommend to all our listeners and viewers, because you will not get this information anywhere else except in our August podcast, Tablets Israel Update. So until next week.